Earners, what's up? Look, I want to talk to you about something that's been a real game changer for us and our business, ShipStation. If you're running an online store, you know how crucial it is to get your orders out quickly and efficiently, but it can also be one of the biggest headaches. That's where ShipStation comes in. With ShipStation, managing and shipping your orders is easier than ever. Whether you're selling on Amazon, Etsy, your own website, or all of the above, ShipStation funnels all your orders onto one simple interface that you can manage from anywhere, even your phone. ShipStation works with all major carriers, including UPS, FedEx, USPS, and more. You can easily compare rates and delivery times to find the best shipping option for you and your customers. Plus, you can automate almost any shipping task like creating shipping labels, tracking packages, and setting notifications for your customers. It's a huge time saver. For us, ShipStation has been a lifesaver. It's taken the stress out of shipping and fulfillment, allowing us to focus more on growing business. And the best part, it's incredibly affordable with options that fit any budget. So if you're ready to take your shipping game to the next level, head over to ShipStation.com and use the promo code EARN to get a 60-day free trial. That's 2 months of hassle-free, stress-free shipping for free. Remember, whether you're shipping a few packages a week or a few thousand, ShipStation makes it easy to manage it all. Go to ShipStation.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in EARN. ShipStation, make ship happen. Earners, what's up? Look, if you're like us, then you pour your heart into creating content. But let's be real. Relying on algorithms to decide the fate of your efforts, that's not the move. That's where Kajabi steps in. It puts you in the driver's seat of your content, brand, and income. As content creators, we know the grind doesn't stop at production. Managing the business side is a whole other game. But guess what? With Kajabi, you don't need to hire a big team or juggle multiple tools. It's your one-stop platform to run your entire online business effortlessly. Here's the scoop. Kajabi is the all-in-one platform that supports entrepreneurs in transforming their passions into profit. Whether it's through an online course, membership sites, or coaching, Kajabi has all the tools you need. And the best part? You keep every penny you make. No revenue sharing here. We've been using Kajabi, and it's a real game changer. The analytics help you track what works, the payment options are a breeze, and the email marketing tools? Well, top-notch. It simplified our lives and let us focus on what we love to do, and that's creating. So, are you ready to take control and stop leaving your success to chance? Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial. Just go to kajabi.com/earn. That's kajabi.com/earn. Join the thousands of creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Going to be a very spirited conversation.
I want to build my own legacy in the wine and spirits industry.
How cost intensive was this journey?
Bank accounts, savings, credit card, all of it was maxed out.
How'd you get American Airlines, convince them to say, look, we need to have this inside of the arena?
I mean, Miami's a rosé culture, so it didn't take a lot.
I got to talk about it. Ace of Spades.
When I was there, we were arch enemies. It was fun to go back and, excuse my friend, shit on people.
What are the marketing goals by territory?
A lot of balancing the nightclub world and then catering to the super wealthy.
Allow equity stakeholders to come in, or we're going to set the whole thing?
I never set my goals on being the number one black-owned rosé brand in the world. No, I'm going to be the number one rosé brand in the world, right. Period.
Welcome back, EYL. This is going to be a very spirited conversation.
all pun intended.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like what you did there.
Yes, yes.
That's clever.
I mean, it might be the first time we ever spoke to somebody that had their own wine company.
Yeah.
Is it? We spoke to a few people in the spirits industry, but not wine.
No, not at this level.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're talking about the fastest growing, yeah, this is the first.
So, Don A. Burstyn.
Yeah.
Originally from Baltimore, Maryland, right?
Absolutely. Be more stand up.
Yeah.
So, how you guys met, right?
So actually, Nicole, shout out to
Nicole Russell?
No, Nicole Spence at Black Effect.
Okay.
He was like, hey, Troy, there's this guy you have to meet. He has an amazing story, amazing. He's saying this like in the spring. I'm like, Nicole, you know, we got this big event that we're doing. So we kind of like on a freeze right now for the interviews. But as soon as we're done with that, let's make it happen. And so she just kept telling me, I'm like, hey, you got anybody? You know, just when we're done, yeah, I got this guy down. Yeah, you got to meet him. He's from Baltimore. He's a Clark grad. You got to meet him. He's crazy. I'm like, all right, let's do it.
Damn.
And so we finally got it on the calendar. So I'm happy that you're here. I'm happy that the spirits are here as well.
Yeah, man. No, I'm excited to be here.
It's an impressive story. And he came prepared with the right kicks. So shout out to him.
Yeah. So. So let's get into this. So you have your own wine company.
Yep.
This is the wine right here, I'm assuming.
Yep, Lafayette Wine Company. That's the rosé and the blanc.
A rosé and a white wine, right?
Yep.
Okay. So let's rewind the story a little bit. Where did your passion for wine come into play, and how did you go about actually becoming an entrepreneur in the space?
Yeah. So I worked in the wine and spirits industry since 2001. Started back with Cavassier, doing the Pastor Cavassier days at D Rush, which was Russell Simmons agency. So mm-hmm. we did all the street promotions in Atlanta. From there, moved over to Moet Hennessy. At the time, it was just Moet and Hennessy as the ambassador in Atlanta. And that was during the time when the clubs in the city was on fire, when the music industry was hot down there, right? So it was
like BMF days.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So it was closest thing to being in the music industry without being in it. Because listen, we've been throwing all the parties. The liquor companies were sponsoring all the parties. And I just fell in love with like that lifestyle. Like it was business, but it was still a lot of fun. So I did that, then moved to Miami with them. And once I got to Miami is when the champagne world took over. So it was like, I worked on Clicquot, I worked on Moet, I worked on Dom Perignon. I was like, oh, this is the move. This is my lane. Left there and then did a stint at Ace of Spades for 3 years.
Might've heard
Latin
of it.
America. Yeah, might've heard of that. Latin America, the Caribbean, Southeast United States and duty free. And I was just like, yo, I could just do this. Working over there with that guy and that team, it was so entrepreneurial and it was so breaking the convention of the wine and spirits industry that it motivated me to want to do my own thing. And then just being in a chance encounter in the south of France and meeting the owner of a winery, and talking shop with them and say, yo, we should do something. And that was the genesis of it all.
Yeah, that was like a fast forward version.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this place in south of France, yeah, Saint-Tropez. Right? Oh, this guy, yeah, Sean Carter. Right? So, I mean, how did you even get, I mean, you said in early 2001, you start.
Yeah,
and you're working with Russell Simmons and his brand, but how did you get to? Because it's not even LVMH at the time, right?
It was an agency for Moet Hennessy called US Concept.
So who introduced you to them? How'd you get on board with them?
Yeah, so I mean, I literally the job with Russell Simmons, it sounds glamorous at D Rush, was literally me handing out drink tickets in the club. Like I was like the promotional guy, thing. And then that grew into me managing the promotional models underneath me, and I happened to be working for. I was doing like 6 jobs at that time. I was like working an internship at Hitco Music Publishing, working with a local events company called Step. So I was just in the mix trying to figure out how I was going to get on. Mm-hmm. And I met a young lady who was the regional marketing person for Hennessy Cognac. And she was like, I like you, you know, I want to give you an opportunity. And that's how that job came about.
So like what happens when you're in that space, the club knows what type of night it's going to be.
Yep.
Right. They'll say like, hey, we got Earn Your Leisure coming.
Yep.
We're going to need this many cases.
Dollars.
Because Earn Your Leisure's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, like, you're doing that. How often is this, like, 3 nights of the week? Like, is this full-time what you're doing?
Yeah, at that point, it was full-time. I mean, the clubs in Atlanta at that time, every night of the week, it was something to do, right? That was true. Mondays, that was Tuesdays. So, the only night we probably really had off was, like, a Wednesday, per se. So, it was 6 days a week in the streets at the clubs. But it was a rotation. It was the same ones every week. It was all about repetition to get in front of people. But, yeah, it was intense.
Yeah, is it commission-based?
No, it was a salary.
Okay.
Salary. Yeah, it was a salary.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, well, what sparked you to go from there to actually saying, I'm going to get up and running and have my own brand?
Listen, we all have had jobs where you felt like you could do things better, right? So that inspiration from being in a place that was super entrepreneurial, but it still wasn't mine, right? And you get reminded of that every now and then, no matter how hard you work. So I was like, you know, I want to do my own thing. I want to build my own legacy in the wine and spirits industry. And this opportunity was that.
So what was the first step that you did to start the company?
Yeah, so the I had to look at what the business proposition was, right? So knowing I had worked on Moet, and Moet Nectar Rosé was the number one selling rosé champagne in the world, and that consumer was 98% Black and Hispanic. And then knowing that the leading rosé still wine brand at the time was Whispering Angel, and there were no real contingency of Black consumers drinking that, the correlation was like, listen, if I can take 10% of the sparkling rosé consumer and 10% of the still rosé consumer and bring them together, then I have a business proposition.
So rosé, 98% of rosé wine drinkers are Black?
Moet Nectar Imperial Rosé, the one in the clear bottle. Yeah. The Moet Rosé.
But the Moet Rosé, my favorite. But
I was going to say, we drink it.
But that's champagne, though.
That's champagne, right.
So when I think of rosé, I think of champagne.
Yeah.
This is wine.
This is wine. So rosé in general is just a varietal, right? It just means, you know, it's made from rare wine grapes, whether it be still or sparkling. It's a different process of making it. There's sugar dosage, there's aging in barrels and stuff for the sparkling. And then for the still, it's pretty much just made without any oxidation to give you the bubbles.
So only Black people drink rosé?
I mean, listen, it's the, yeah.
Why is that? Because it's red?
No, it was the marketing. I mean, that was
marketed in the club.
Hip-hop,
in
right?
The, the red, I'm going to be honest with you, the red was a great, it comes red?
Yeah, it comes red. The big thing about it was red in a clear bottle. So before that, most rosés were in a darker bottle. So
it lights up. And, they put the light underneath it.
You could see it. It was a show. It was
well, like you couldn't even see what's in the bottle.
Exactly.
So what's the market share? Like, how much money does that represent? You could say 100% is done by Black people, let's just say, if it's 98%. How much money does Moet Rosé make?
I would probably say it's the third biggest value generator inside of Moet Hennessy USA. Because it's really a US-based brand as well.
So it'd be like Hennessy is number one.
Hennessy number one. Probably a tie between, and this is when I was there, probably a tie between Moet and Clicquot. And then Moet Imperial, the regular sparkling, and then that would be number three. Yeah,
not that white stuff.
It's a huge, huge business proposition,
and that was from a nightclub. That's just pretty much from
a
nightclub.
I mean, it was a culture. In the beginning, it was nightclub culture. Yeah, so it was primarily sold only in nightclubs, but now retail as well. But yeah.
So retail. I'm glad you said that because I was reading 2011, perfect time to be in Miami.
Oh yeah,
LeBron has now said he's coming.
That's crazy.
And so how did you get the arena? So it was American Airlines. I know it's like FTX now.
Yes.
How'd you get American Airlines, convince them to say, look, we need to have this inside of the arena? Because that wasn't something that you saw anywhere.
No, it wasn't. And the first conversation was really about the championship celebration. So we was already in like...
Oh, we winning.
September, we're going to like, let's prepare. And there was a rule that apparently Pat didn't let anybody talk about if they won. So that conversation quickly changed until let's talk about what we can do to bring like more of a social aspect to the basketball games. Because in Miami during that time, you went to the games because like that was the club. Like, did you even watch the game? No, I was inside Hyde. So, we wanted to see what could we do to promote at that time Moet and the white bottle, Moet Ice, to kind of all tie it in. So we convinced them that we should sell the champagne at the bars first. And they were like, all right, this is cool. This is going well. We like this. They like the vibe. Then we did some branded cups. And then next thing you know, we had our own pop-up bar in the concourse. And it was outselling every other like bar in the arena. Then we just decided, let's make this an official partnership. And once they won that year, it was game over.
So as far as the wine, where do you get the grape? So, all right, the process of making wine is that there's grapes and they crush the grapes, right?
Yep.
And then they have to let it sit for a long time.
Anywhere from 3 to 4 months.
They age it.
Macerating, letting it all come together in gel. Not so much age. Aging is like usually a year, 2 year process. We don't do that. So it's a little quicker than that.
All right. You have your own farm or you just outsource it to like?
So we have a winery partner. So there's a vineyard in the south of France in Saint-Tropez that we work with exclusively. They produce their own label, primarily in France. And then we work with them to get a style of wine that we wanted for Lafette.
So they make like gallons of wine.
Yeah, like bottles a year.
And then they ship it to you.
Yeah.
Is this proprietary to you, this taste, or do they?
Well, everything in wine making typically is blending process, right? And it changes every year because some years harvest is better than others. It's a very volatile industry. So you try to get a style of wine and then you try to make that style every year, but it's never going to be exactly the same. It's impossible unless you're making it in a factory.
So what makes wine? So like one of the, like, I'm not a wine connoisseur, but like LeBron and DJ, when they have like wine cellars and it's like some bottles worth like a $50,000. Yeah. Like what makes wine high class? What makes some wine better than other wines? Like how do you gauge that?
So France is heavily regulated in how they classify their vineyards and winery and terroir. So when you go to like Burgundy and Bordeaux, those are like premium, some of them are premium wineries, small production, like how long do they age? How do they taste after they age? So all of that sort of thing adds into what puts the value to wine and scarcity. I mean, it's a commodity. So if you have a great vintage and they only produce 1,000 bottles, 10 years from now, those 1,000 bottles could be worth $10,000 a bottle per se.
So Saint-Tropez comes up in a story.
Yeah.
Did you know that going in, or is this like as you're traveling, doing the other brands, you're starting to see and you're learning from where they're going? And
no.
So how did Saint-Tropez come into the mix?
Puff had that line, and I need a girl, right? Ever been to Saint-Tropez? So I literally took that as the reason to go there for my birthday, right?
Yeah,
crazy shit.
Yeah.
Like, never been, I'm going.
Yeah.
But when you go... And during that era, that's when Puff and all of them were there every summer. So the energy, again, was crazy. It was just like, yo, this is the best place on earth. So whenever I had the chance to get back to France or Paris for work, I would beeline my way back down the south. And it just became like my place. So I fell in love with the place. And a part of that lifestyle in that place is rosé wine. Yeah.
So, all right. So you get the contract to get the wine from France. And then you put it in your bottles.
Yep. No, it's all bottled. Everything's bottled, full production.
They label it for you and all that?
Everything.
All right. So where are you selling it? In stores or?
Yeah, right now we're up to about 1,000 points of distribution.
But like when you first started?
When I first started, literally 4 hotels in Miami.
4.
You just hand to hand?
I just went to everybody I had relationships with from, you know, years in the industry and said, yo, I got this rosé. And, you know, the good ones were like, all right, we like you. We're going to give it a shot. It don't sell, that's on you, but we'll give it a shot.
Did you tell them it was yours?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
So how'd you get it to sell?
I mean, Miami's a rosé culture, so it didn't take a lot, right? Oh. It was just like,
a chance with it?
Yeah, you're in a W hotel.
And just go.
I mean, one thing we did do that other people weren't doing is because we were produced in Saint-Tropez, is we put that, you know how they list wine? It would say Lafite Rosé, Saint-Tropez. So most people that were in and out of the W and the Satay hotels in Miami had been to Saint-Tropez. So that was something that automatically their eyes were drawn.
It resonated with them.
It resonated with them, absolutely.
A taste of the culture.
Yeah.
So Lafite, nice name.
Yeah.
I know what it means. Explain why you landed on that.
Yeah, so Lafite du Rosé, the full formal name, means the rosé party. And so for us, the tagline is a party and everyone's invited. Because typically in wine in general has been very exclusive and not inclusive, right? So we wanted to create a brand that was definitely bringing everyone into it, right? Black, white, Chinese, gay, straight, whatever, it didn't matter. It was just like, yo, we like rosé. So it's more of a lifestyle play than it is a wine play. Like, we could have gone with the typical, you know, blah, 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 Chateau Vernier, you know, whatever. Like, that didn't resonate with any of us. We wanted a name that would definitely pop and then we could, you know, bring to life.
Yeah, so this is the entrepreneurial journey, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that people, you hear in their stories is that, you know, I spent my last to get this off the ground.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Like, how cost intensive was this journey from obviously being in Saint-Tropez to having tastings to having finally figured out the bottling and I guess at the beginning, the marketing of it?
Yeah.
That's one of your strongholds.
Yeah.
How cash intensive was it for you?
Everything. So to that point, I took my last. I emptied out 401ks. I dipped into pension funds, bank accounts, savings, credit cards. All of it was maxed out to make this dream happen. Yeah. Because you have to pay for it. Regardless if it's sold or not, like you basically put your order in for wine now and you'll get it in March. So it wasn't something I could like pick up and decide like next month, like I need to get 5,000 bottles. They were like, no, you want 5,000, you need to pay for all of it now. So
you say you're in 1,000 stores now?
1,000 stores now.
So how'd you get into stores and how'd you scale that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the pandemic was a blessing for us as a brand because that's the point that everybody slowed down and they started to watch and racial injustice movements and George Floyd and everyone started wanting to support black brands. And at that moment, we just took off. The brand took off and we put you know, the pedal to the metal and kept going. So that got the attention of the retailers and, you know, these big corporations that wanted to support black owned and minority owned brands. And that gave us the foot in the door. A lot of that has started to go away, but we were able to maintain our sales and volume to stay there when these initiatives start to, you know, dwindle down a little bit.
What are some of the costs associated with obviously creating a luxury line of wine, right? Like, obviously you said if I want 5,000 bottles, I got to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
But those 5,000 bottles have to be stored somewhere,
mm-hmm.
right? So they have to be transported. So like, what are some of those costs that most people don't even think of that yeah. associated with this business?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, again, the goods, the cost of goods sold, the bottle, the glass, the cork, the label, the paper, the wine itself. Then there's getting it from France on a container to the United States. Then there's the custom import fees, duty taxes you got to pay once it lands.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the storage at whatever warehouse you select. Then if you don't have a big distributor, because it's a three-tier system, which means we basically can't sell direct to consumers, we have to sell to a distributor. That distributor then sells to a retailer, that retailer then sells to the consumer, and everybody takes their cut along the way. You got to figure out how to then convince them to buy it. But if they're not buying the product, you're just paying those storage fees along the way. And some of them may say you pay for trucking or shipping to get it to us. So then that's another cost on top of it.
So that, I mean, that's a lot of people taking money.
Yeah.
So that's why the bottles cost so much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, everybody wants typically 25 to 30% minimum along the way.
Profit margin.
Damn.
So like how much would it cost to start an operation like this? Like,
ooh, the right way. I mean, when we officially launched in 2019, it was $1 million in inventory alone. And that was without the marketing.
And that's not marketing or anything like that.
No, that was just the inventory and getting it here and all that stuff. So I would probably say effectively the right way, $1.5 million, $2 million. And that's playing small.
Mm. What about marketing? So what kind of marketing do you do?
Now we're doing all digital. We're starting to come out of that now, the experiential and the events are coming back. But primarily during the pandemic, it was digital ads. It was a lot of influencer marketing. Everyone was at home, so we could just send bottles to people and they would post. But for us, we try to immerse people in the lifestyle of what we think Saint-Tropez is and what we want people to feel when they experience the product. So we take cues from spirit brands. We think they do it best in terms of like how they activate. We don't want to operate like a wine brand. So wine dinners are cool, but like that's not a lot of fun. It's fun to some people, but we want to immerse you in it. So it's going to be parties. It's going to be festivals. It's going to be F1. It's going to be all those things that are really a part of like the dope things that are happening in the culture. We want Lafette to be there.
What kind of influences did you have in your influencer marketing?
Yeah, initially it was whoever had a large following, to be honest with you. But it was also people that were posting wine or champagne brands. And then we got lucky with, you know, people like Mello. He put us on his show during the pandemic.
He has a podcast?
He had a YouTube series called What's in Your Glass.
Where he interviews people drinking wine?
Yeah, yeah.
He put you on or he had to put your product in?
He put us on. He put me on. So he and I talked. He's from Baltimore. So we got connected through his manager. W-B. And we got put on through that. And then Michael Strahan talked about it. A friend of a friend got him the product. D Nice held up a bottle doing his Instagram live. So it was a lot of good things. Like it just started happening in a good way. So we had people reaching out and then we were reaching out to people as well. Yeah.
I got to talk about it. Ace of Spades, you're there.
Yeah, yeah.
Couple things. First of all, you're the regional director.
Yep.
So I want to know what, you know, that role encompasses. But also, obviously, we saw that LVMH,
mm-hmm.
a company that you know.
Yeah.
Has now 50% stake of Ace of Spades. Now, the second part is, were you there at that point or did you help, I guess, kind of facilitate the relationship between the two brands?
No, I mean, when I was there, we were arch enemies. So when I was at mm-hmm. Domperignon, Ace was an enemy. And when I was at Ace, Domperignon was an enemy. So it was no playing in the sandbox whatsoever. Yeah. but what we did see, what I saw once I got to Ace is that the young consumer had no affinity for Domperignon the way they did for Ace of Spades. So if you're LVMH, you have great product in Domperignon, that's your Tête Cuvée, but your consumer is aging out, right? Mm-hmm. And Ace was grabbing that young, rich consumer around the world, like India, Asia, Dubai, like they were going to Ace in the club where their parents might've been drinking Domperignon. So I think that's, if I had to make a hypothesis, that's what LVMH saw, the mm-hmm. future. It wasn't right now. It's like, okay, these young guys aren't picking Domperignon, they're picking Ace. But the experience was great. Like I said, it was super entrepreneurial. Like Dez, that ran the whole operation over there, was very much like, yo, beat the street, break convention, break the rules. How do we get this done? And that was kind of like our directive. But it was a lot of work because for me, coming from the LVMH side at the time, it was easy to get in the door, right? But when I got to Ace, some of those same doors were like, yeah, I don't know. We don't really have that crowd here. And I just be like, what does that mean?
Your crowd doesn't make money?
Yeah, exactly, right? So it was a lot of trying to convince some of the old guard that this was a real champagne. Yeah, the bottle is gold for a reason, to stand out, and it worked. So it was fun. It was fun to go back and, excuse my friend, shit on people, so to speak, right? To be like, oh yeah, you was talking shit. And now, fast forward 3 years, that same company that you was holding in high praise owns 50% of that brand.
Right.
So
yeah,
how do you feel about it now?
I'm a gold bottle drinker. So I know some of the role was marketing goals for each territory.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, right? So you had, what were the areas that you were responsible for?
So Southeast United States,
yeah.
Latin America being more of like Cuba, Dominican Republic, et cetera, and duty-free zone.
So what are the marketing goals by territory? Like, give me an example of something that will work in Southeast, obviously United States, and then, all right, well, this is what we're going to do for the duty-free zones.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, if I use Miami as an example, there was two aspects to Miami. There was the club life, for sure. You got to make sure Ace is popping and Live and all those places like that. But it was also, how do you get in front of high net worth individuals in settings that they want to be a part of? Watches was a big way. We did a lot of watch partnership dinners and parties. Mm-hmm. Yachts and boat shows was another way. So you have to really, when you get to the high net worth individual in marketing, you got to go to their touch points. You can't just be one of those brands like, I'm going to do it my way, especially for a brand like Ace. Like, let me ingratiate myself in your world first before we come in and kicking down the door. So it was a lot of balancing the nightclub world and then catering to the super wealthy in their sort of environments, which is a hard balancing act, right? Because most people think of Ace as the club brand. So it was a lot of hurdles to overcome with convincing people otherwise.
Mm. Speaking of nightclub, nobody drinks wine in a club. So
they will soon. But that's
the day has come.
In the US, they don't drink it. You can go to nightclubs in France and south of France and Paris, and you'll see people drinking rosé wine at nighttime in a club.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a cultural thing. Like, wine has a long way to go here in the States in terms of marketing. And that's primarily because the gatekeepers for wine, the Psalms and all that, have put so much fuss on it, right? So you and I, we go to the club. If I can't put an ice cube in if it's not cold enough, or if I have to, you know, sniff and swirl, like, you can be like, yo, I'm not doing all that. I'm trying to have fun. Let me get busy. Mm-hmm. So for us, we like, let's break convention. You drink it how you want. If you want to go make a rosé margarita with that and some Don Julio or tequila brand, go ahead. So
tequila or wine?
Yeah. So we have a rosé margarita, which is basically, you know, four parts rosé wine and one part tequila. Shake it up. It's crazy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in America, nobody's really drinking wine in the club. So, and I would assume that that's a big part of the revenue stream for alcohol, for every alcohol, tequila, you name it, champagne, all of the alcohols have huge profit margins in nightclubs.
Yeah, but Tito's is the number one selling vodka in the world, and probably 10% of their business in nightclubs.
A lot of people drink Tito's in clubs, though.
Now they do. But when I used to work on Belvedere, too, you couldn't pay a nightclub owner to serve Tito's, because for them, it was like, get that cheap shit out of here, whatever. You know what I mean? Right. But now you look at Tito's sales, what is it, 3 million cases a year, maybe 4? I can guarantee you 90% of that is coming from retail or bars, not excluding clubs. You know what I mean?
So you're saying you don't need clubs to survive?
By no means.
So who, all right. So what's the average client? Somebody that's just having wine at dinner?
So for rosé, no. So typically rosé has been more outdoorsy, brunchy, warm weather spots. We're now starting to see the shift as we push for like ski season, you know, après-ski sort of things like that. And then just every day, like, you're starting to see more people drink wine at dinner or even at home than you would have 4 or 5 years ago.
This is true.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about my own house.
Yeah.
this is true. So, man, how, because you said you were doing, I think, 1,000? The different locations you have right now?
Now, yeah.
How do we get to that point, right? You start with one, obviously, but how do we scale so fast? I think in 2021, you the fastest growing rosé?
Fastest growing imported rosé.
In the country?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah, I mean, listen, like I said, when the momentum hit for us, like, we were on the phones, we were presenting to the buyers from, you know, these big chain stores, you know, hotels and resorts in Miami, let's go get in front of them. Like, look at all the momentum we have. Because, you know, again, Miami, Texas, well, I should say Florida, Texas, and maybe one other state were the only places open post-pandemic that mm-hmm. everyone was rushing to. So we were just creating that critical mass in those cities and out there and putting people in front of the brand and saying, yo, look at all this press. Look at our gram. Look who was holding us up. You know, all that sort of thing that gets people to even say yes. So it was a lot of pitching, a lot of selling. A lot of selling, not in a sense of beating the street, but a lot of selling in terms of presenting to decision makers to get these national distribution deals, like a One Hotel, an Edition Hotel, a Hyatt Hotel Group. It's a lot of those meetings.
So do you have red wine?
Red wine's coming. Yeah. Okay. Man.
So right now you have the Blanco and the Rosé.
Yeah.
And the red wine's coming.
Red wine's coming.
Out of the Blanco and the Rosé, which one is a better seller?
Oh, we just launched the white wine as a thank you last year. Okay. So this is the first full year that's going to be in production. But it's different occasions, right? You have some places that don't take, you know, rosé as serious and they'll go for the white first. Or you have some people that are huge Sauvignon Blanc fans, they'll go for the white first. So if you look at the rosé category, the wine category in general, white wine is by far a bigger seller than rosé overall. Rosé sales are probably 6 to 9% of total table wine sales in the United States, period. White wine is like 27 to 30%. So the growth potential is bigger on the white wine from a business economic standpoint than it is on a rosé. Bigger piece of the pie.
This man knows his wine. He has his statistics. You said the pandemic obviously escalated and elevated the brand.
Mm-hmm.
May 2021,
mm-hmm.
I know you were one of the first to take a payment from Constellation Brands. Can you explain to who Constellation Brands is? And why did they choose you to invest in? Obviously, we know with the pandemic and obviously social unrest that happened, you know, companies were committing money to brands.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you go about, you know, getting them involved?
Yeah, so Constellation is a drinks giant, probably the number two wine company in the world. They also distribute and own Corona beer in the United States, but also some of your favorite brands like Kim Crawford.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right. We're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shari, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the home buying blueprint, volume 1 and volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
Never heard of that. Prisoner Wine is another one of their brands. But that conversation really came about once the announcement came out. You know, again, community is everything. People were just hitting me. And two people in particular had relationships with executives at Constellation. So that gave me, I think, a quicker intro to the system. So when we sat down and talked, it was all about what do you see for the brand? Where do you think it's going to be in 3 to 5 years? It was never an immediate thing. It was like, we want to understand your vision, what you're trying to accomplish. And for me, again, it was disrupting the rosé industry and the wine industry to bring more people of color into it, right? That was my thing from day one. Like, this is a multi-billion dollar industry and we don't really own a lot of it. So they understood that journey. And then they also understood that, like, listen, you have a vision and you have a niche. Like, you're bringing new consumers into the rosé space. So it was a lot of conversation about that and the future of the brand, but it was a long process. It was like a 9-month due diligence negotiation process.
Yeah. They had allocated, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, they said they were going to allocate, is it 100 million to brands?
100 million over 10 years.
Over 10 years.
Over 10 years.
To owners of wine companies who were African-American?
Spirits. Wine and spirits. People of color that owned alcoholic beverage brands, put it that way. Yeah.
And so just a 9-month process. You had the percentage of, that's pretty shocking, 98% of the people who consume rosé look like us.
Yep.
How many people were even in the running for it or even were aware that this was actually taking place and they could have taken advantage of it?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not even sure about that. I'm not even sure. But listen, I think the hard part for all these companies that announce venture opportunities is, are we ready as a people that own the business, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think I was ready when I started the conversation. I had great advisors that got me ready throughout the process. But due diligence is a weeding out process, a lot of it, right? Yeah. So I don't think a lot of us understand what it takes to get to that point. What do your financials look like? what do your projections look like, your balance sheet, your income statement? Like, that's a learning process in itself. So I think a lot of people have businesses, but when you get to that point, if someone's going to give you money and invest in you, like, that's a whole different thing beyond, is your bottle pretty? And is, you know, that sort of thing, right? So I think that's been the challenge for a lot of these companies, why you haven't seen so many announcements. Because for me, it's not really, I think the challenge is, it shouldn't be ventures in terms of investing in brands that are already doing well. It should be incubation for our community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's kind of misguided and should be redirected.
So what's your plans on scaling? Like, how do you take it to the next level? Is it through influencer marketing? Is it through just, you know, hitting the pavement?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple ways, right? The thing for us is we are being very cautious of scaling too fast. Right? Because we can go get 4,000 more doors tomorrow. But if the product's not pulling out the door, then you're discontinued. So what did you really do it for us? Right? So we're trying to be very strategic in looking at DMAs of how we go to market. So we don't look at a whole state. Like, for instance, in New York, we're looking at Brooklyn and then lower Manhattan, restaurants, bars. And then our community is in Brooklyn, has been supporting us since day one. When we look at somewhere like Texas, it may not be downtown Dallas, Highland Park area, it may be Frisco, where more of us live, you know, have a little bit more money. So we're really breaking it down that way and doing deep dives in those areas with influencers that live in those areas, marketing campaigns in those areas, whether it be digital, and you'd be surprised, even radio, terrestrial radio in those markets are working as well.
It's part of the marketing campaign. I know, like, there's companies that just deliver the wine, mm-hmm. like Drizzly mm-hmm. is a company that I know that you do. Is that part of the marketing plan too? Like, we're going to, yeah. rather than having to be in the stores, we'll just actually put it on a company like Drizzly and get it out to the people?
Yeah, but you still need distribution, because the way Drizzly works is they use the stores in their area as their delivery mechanism. So if you're not available and you go on Drizzly, you can put in the name of the product and say, sorry, not available in your area. But we did use the research of saying, all right, where's Drizzly's big markets, and cross-reference that against the areas we want to be in and say, we need to have a consolidation of stores there, so if someone goes on Drizzly, they can actually get it.
Are there, so what are some cities, like looking forward into the future, what are some cities or targets that you have that you're not in right now?
I mean, we're in 34 markets, but are we really in them? No. So we have pockets, a lot of it based upon some of the hotel chains that we have agreements with, that we rush those markets ahead of time. We certainly could dive deeper in LA. We certainly could dive deeper in New York City alone. Like, our presence here is small, strong, but small. I mean, this is the number one selling rosé market in the United States for 7 months out of the year. So you know, we definitely got to crack New York City.
And you said throughout the year, so 7 months out. So what months are those? Like, how does that?
Usually you start planning in New York, February, March, it kicks off, September. When it starts to get October and it gets cold.
When it gets cold, people aren't drinking rosé anymore.
In the past, they haven't. They're starting to change, but typically, no. Buyers won't even bring in a new rosé in October.
I wasn't even thinking that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to be here in New York to win. Then Florida for sure. Chicago is a big rosé market, so we're going to crack that. And then Texas and California. I mean, all the major markets for sure, but it's just how deep do you go inside of them?
Yeah, we got to stop going to places without having to...
So what about overseas?
Yeah, so we again, through partnerships with hotels, we have a national partnership, global partnership with Soho House. So the white wine will be in all the Soho Houses here in the United States and in the UK and rest of the world. We are sold at our winery in a couple spots in France, but next year we're going to go deep, because again, if you're talking about lifestyle and what we want to be a part of, we need to be in Mykonos. We need to be in Ibiza. Everywhere all of us are going and traveling every year, you should show up and see Lafette there. Mm.
Now, one of the things that I read that you do is you donate proceeds.
Yeah.
Don't really see that too often.
Yeah.
Is that something that you intentionally went into the business saying, like, I want to give back, mm-hmm. Because, you know, that's just part of my DNA, who I am.
Yeah.
Where did that come about, and how is that going?
Yeah. So for me, again, I love travel, right? Man, I love traveling. I know what travel did to me. It changed my life, traveling around the world with Moët Hennessy and post-college and all that stuff. So I knew I wanted to give that same opportunity to kids earlier, and kids that may never have the opportunity. Like, for me, it didn't happen until I was 24, 25. But you talk to a lot of my coworkers in corporate America, and they've been traveling since they was 12, 15, 16. They have a circuit they go through every summer with their friends. And I wanted to give our kids, our community, that experience. So there's an organization called All Abroad, and they actually take underserved kids from Atlanta and now in Baltimore on trips in high school. They just came back from Kenya. It was about 10 kids. And we want to expand that, because the more we can expose our kids beyond their neighborhood, block, city, state, we just all become better people. And it makes them better business people, better students, better doctors, lawyers, whatever, because now they have a global perspective on how things work. But it's hard. I mean, listen, you have to commit to actually giving money from sales, whether you're getting those sales or not. I can't tell that organization, I'm going to give you $50,000, $100,000, and then at the end of the year say, sorry, I didn't get the sales. I can't do it. I mean, that's unfair. So we purposely allot money that has to go to those organizations because we believe in them so much.
What about expanding outside of wine? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I'm probably going to do a sparkling wine. Not a champagne, because it's not producing champagne. And then mezcal is my favorite. So I'm looking at some mezcal propositions right now. First, I got to get this to the point where there's an exit, and then we'll roll to the next one.
That's great. You said exit, and I was thinking to myself, obviously you build a brand, and we just came from Ace, and we saw them give 50% of the ownership away. Is that something that's on the board? Like, as soon as we build this brand to a certain point? Because a lot of times we create businesses, a lot of people create them to sell them at some point.
Yeah.
Is that the vision for your brand, or we're going to build it to at some point? We're going to allow equity stakeholders to come in, or we're going to sell the whole thing completely?
I mean, if the number's right, you can get the whole thing. but certainly, yeah, I think the mistake a lot of us making, certainly, you know, our older parents, whatever, when they had business, they held on to them forever, and they don't really think about the exit. But we can create generational wealth with a sale. Then we can all go do something else and flip it and keep more business. So for me, this is a tough business. It's tough as hell. So if I can exit healthy, get some money, and then go flip that into some other things, why not? But yeah, we're selling. To answer your question, sure. Yeah. We're definitely selling.
When you started this, did you ever reach out? Did you get any help from the people at Ace of Spades? Or
I never asked.
Your old connection? No?
Yeah, no, I never asked. I mean, look, and let me just, let's be honest about it. Like, what am I going to go, Jay, I'm launching a rosé brand. Will you help me? Like, we never really had that.
Because he didn't have wine, right?
But we never had that really sort of interaction. Like, that hierarchy there is like, Desiree is it, right? So I certainly wasn't going to be like, yo, can you help me with the rosé?
You knew her?
We had one a couple. One
okay.
Of, yeah. It was, yeah.
The boss.
Yeah, the boss, right? But I mean, it was just one of those things where I wanted to do it on my own without that, because I also didn't want it to be a celebrity brand, right? So that was another reason why I didn't look at that from the outset. I wanted it to be a brand that was truly, really built by an industry veteran.
Do celebrity brands have less credibility in the, like, spirit world? Like, are they looked at as like, oh, this is not credible because a celebrity owns it?
No, but I think that's become the cookie cutter approach. Like, everybody now, like, who's your celebrity? You're like, damn, could you taste it first? Could we talk about it? Like,
you got back in this thing.
Yeah, and then a lot of them don't work. I think, you know, we all see the successes and think like it's a recipe and a formula, and sometimes it just isn't. Like, so there have been a lot of celebrity failures out there as well.
So let me ask you this. It's a French name. Mm-hmm. It has, previously, I don't think it has it on these bottles, but it has the location. It's off of France Saint-Tropez.
Yep.
Wouldn't automatically expect it was owned by somebody black.
Right.
But you're doing interviews, so obviously you're in the forefront.
Yep.
Did you ever think about not putting yourself out there? Because a lot of times, unfortunately, it's like once we realize something is black,
we ain't rocking.
It's two things happen. The white people classified as black brand, and even some black people might look at it a different way.
Yeah.
So, but then on the other side, you get support for being a black business, right? Like Carmelo, and he probably did that because you're from Baltimore, you're black. It's like, okay, he's black, he has a wine. Why not show them love? So it can go either way, but I can see how, you know, being labeled as like a black business, a black brand, can be harmful.
Yeah. So in the beginning, no, I did not. And my PR team, the PR team was like adamant that I get out there and talk about myself being the owner and founder, because I had no interest. I wanted the product to live on itself for that very reason. I didn't want it to be stigmatized as like a black owned brand. And we deal with that to this day. So I tell everybody, yes, it's owned by a black person, but it's not only for black people. And I have to say that because everyone's like, black rosé. I'm just like, come on. You know what I mean? Like, no, it's a luxury rosé from the south of France, from Saint-Tropez, that's owned by a black man. So you totally get that. I think the challenging part was to make sure that it did look and feel luxury, right? Because you could say you're a high-end luxury wine. So for us, it was important that everything about it felt like the competitive set. So you can never say, oh, but that's less than. There's nothing less than about this product. We can go toe-to-toe with the best of them. And I never set my goals on being the number one Black-owned rosé brand in the world. No, I want to be the number one rosé brand in the world, period.
Yeah, I mean, so the white wine, mm-hmm. obviously, and you said you're going into red. I'm just trying to think now, like, you have the PR team.
Yep.
Right? We obviously know you're the owner. Who's coming up with the ideas for expansion? Who's a part of the team that has helped this grow so fast in such a short time, right? Because we're talking maybe 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
So who's the people that are around you that have helped you get here in a sense of, did you, you know, create relationships as you've grown from brand, obviously from Moët mm-hmm. to Ace of Spade, obviously maybe with the people at the Heat. Are you looking at people like, as you're growing, like, all right, I like this person. When I start mine, I want to come back and find this person. How did you build a team? Who is the team?
Yes, when I built, the team is still only four of us, which is crazy. Wow. We do a lot of, and that's the internal sales.
The whole team is almost here.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, for the most part.
That's a first.
But again, I take a very like outsourced mentality to a lot of things, right? So there's certain projects we'll tap into the network. I know this person was good at X when I worked on this brand. This person was good at X when I worked on that brand. And you tap into them for those specific areas. The last thing we wanted to do was to be so heavy on salaries that we didn't have cash flow to do what we needed to do to move. So for that reason, we didn't hire a lot of people. But yeah, we definitely tap into those networks. Like, there's group chats of everything that happens. Label design, Instagram captions, like it just flows around. And then you have to bounce stuff off of other people to really get that real input. Not too many people, because too much feedback is bad. But that trusted in the circle through over the years, yeah. Mm.
So let me ask you this. As far as the Rosé and the Blanco is concerned, do you have an idea, long-term vision, like, is in your perfect world, would it be 50-50 split? Well, now you got the red wine too. Is it like a 50-50 or 33-33, or is the Rosé always going to be the flagship product and the other ones are kind of like ancillary?
That's a good question. You know, ideally, because we started with the Rosé, it should always be our flagship. But based upon the share market that white wine and red wine has, you would think that they will overtake the Rosé someday. But for me personally, it's going to always be the Rosé.
Rosé is a champion.
Yeah.
How much of your day does this consume, right? Because do you have other interests outside of doing wine? Or is this, wine has become, because I'm listening to you talk and I'm like, he knows all the statistics for him. Pretty well versed in this. Does this consume most of your day, or do you have other interests in investing or something else?
I mean, for now, this is day in, day out. And that's because we're at this inflection point where you gotta, either you go now or the window and it's gonna be closed, right? So we have to focus. I have to focus. It's important to know what my competitors are doing, what's happening in the space. So I spend a good portion of my day, my girl would probably say way too much of my day on this business. Yeah.
So the people that you used to work for now, your biggest competitors.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And they all watching. Like, you look at LinkedIn and your Instagram story, she's like, oh, all of them. You know what I'm saying?
So I know. She's looking at my story.
Yeah.
has there been any negative issues, feedback, anything?
You mean from previous?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, Jay's a big name. People use his name for clickbait. I don't say it, but people see Ace of Spades and then it becomes like, oh, you work for Jay-Z? I was like, I never said that. You know what I mean? Like, so you deal with that. I haven't heard that personally, but I know that's probably a sore spot over there, right? And then for the previous company, you know, they never thought that I could leave and do something like this. So, and we're growing, and we're nipping at their heels, and we are the younger, cooler, great tasting rosé.
I feel like you wanted to say something else.
Yeah.
What a fresh, so freshest shit on the block.
So, so there's a lot of black people that are in the spirits world, but mm-hmm. most of the time they're like brand ambassadors or influencers, or like they run the marketing team. What's your advice for somebody that it wants to become an entrepreneur in the space, but doesn't really know how to go about it, but might be passionate or might be in the business already.
I mean, listen, I did rotations, whatever job and brand, for the most part, they wanted me to take in that business. At the time I was at those companies, you do it because you learn so much. Even at the time, it feels like hell. You're like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, you learn something, like from working sales on the street, from working duty free, from having to work, you know, with the finance team every day and going through POs and reconciliations and all that stuff like that. You do learn the business. And I think, you know, in order for us to start heading these major corporations, as we all will in years to come, we got to start knowing every aspect of the business. Most CEOs, even if they're not doing it daily, if they sit in front of that board, they better be able to take those darts and understand what's happening in every sector. So to your point, well, why I have to know the statistics, I got to know what's going on with freight. I got to know what's going on with price increases, all that sort of thing, if the brand's going to be successful. So I tell everybody in the industry, start as an ambassador, but take the jobs and the brands that don't sound sexy because you'll learn something. Mm-hmm. I've worked with some unsexy brands before, and it's benefited me now, for sure.
You said that the brand took off during the pandemic, mm-hmm. but during the pandemic, a lot of companies had supply chain issues.
Yeah.
How'd you guys alleviate that?
Oh, we was putting stuff on airplanes.
The Frank Lucas of wine.
Yeah, but also you got, if you think about it, states were shutting down, right? So if markets were shutting down, we were rerouting that inventory to places that were doing well. But we did run out of stock. I mean, we ran out of stock like 2-3 times. Like, sales were flying. We'd be out of stock. And we got to try to get it, be 2-3 weeks out of stock. So it was a lot of outages for us as well. It's just how you come out of them. Good thing is that everybody was understanding that it was taking 5 to 10 days to get a wine bottle. It should have been there in 2-3, but you know, we got through it. But it's still tough to this day. I mean, containers that are leaving France, 4 weeks transit time is 6 weeks transit time. Then it gets to the port, it's sitting there for another 2 weeks. Luckily, we have the refrigeration units and everything in place to keep the wine good, but it's a lot of people that got bad wine and booze sitting out there on those docks. It's just going to be flooded into the market here soon, and we'll see.
But actually, the pandemic might have been good for you, because I don't forget, I was in Brooklyn the night where they was about to shut down the city. And I drove past a liquor store, and I actually went to a liquor store, and the owner was saying that it was the best day ever, even better than New Year's.
Yeah.
New Year's Eve is traditionally the best day, I think, for like those local liquor stores. And he was like, that day was better than New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
So I say that to say, once people realized that they was going to be locked down,
yeah,
they was buying alcohol.
Crazy.
Did you see an uptick in your product?
Uptick. Like, it was, we were up like 300% during the pandemic, literally 300%. Like, it was crazy. Like, the website was crashing. We were running out of stock. Stores were running out of stock. Like, and it's sad, right? Because it was such a horrible time, but man, it was a blessing for us. Like, it was a blessing.
I remember seeing them Instagram posts. Like, you want to know how what your neighbor's doing? Look at their garbage.
Yeah.
It was like, they went down the street and everybody had like 7 bottles of wine.
That's it. You had nothing like, else to do.
That was it. You were just sitting home drinking wine. Like, when are we going to be able to go back outside? Yeah. So, you recall. So, what's the toughest obstacle, right? Because you said this shit is hard. And it sounds, this isn't an easy thing. So, what's been some of the toughest obstacles that you had to have faced during this journey of entrepreneurism in the world of spirits?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm still, regardless of the years of industry experience, we're still judged differently than some of our other brands, competitors, I should say. A lot of them get green lights and yeses a lot faster, and I still have to explain why we're better. No, we're not this. No, we're not that. So the gatekeepers in this industry, and more importantly than that, the three-tier system itself is the most gangster shit out here, right? Because as I explained to you, I can't sell my product directly to any consumer. I have to sell it to a distributor. I then have to then rely on that distributor and his sales force to go potentially present it to a retailer for the retailer to carry it for you to buy. It's a broken system. Like, mm-hmm. You look at beauty brands, you look at most, you know, fashion brands, they can go straight from the warehouse, their website, to a consumer. We don't control any of that. So I'm at the mercy of these 5 or 6 big distributor families to present my brand in order for consumers to buy it. Like, that's a problem.
Yeah. So what's the incentive for them to even say, let's move yours?
Yeah.
Like, is this a situation where, like, I could come in, I might have more capital than you, like, hey, listen, distributor, whatever their name is, yo, here's $1 million under the table, make sure this gets off your shelves. Whereas somebody who doesn't have that type of capital is just like, I'll move it if I want to.
Yeah, those are like the I don't know how that.
Perhaps.
but listen, they focus on right now. And the issue is that you have these large conglomerates like a LVMH, like a Diageo, partnering with the distributor. They get all the focus and attention, and then all the other 4,000 brands are thrown into one division together with 10 sales reps that's supposed to like go out here and present like 4,000 brands. So that's why it's incumbent upon us to like build the brand heat to hope that's the part that retailers will keep asking. I mean, consumers will keep asking the retailers, yo, you got this brand.
What is that?
That retailer then called a distributor. But the three-tier system is broken. Like it's the most anti-competitive thing I've ever seen in my life. Like it's nuts.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Before we wrap, what's your 5-year, 10-year plan for your company? What do you have envisioned?
Yeah, we're going to, like I said, the white wine will become a full-time SKU in 2023. We expect gangbusters for that. We'll continue to develop and penetrate other markets for the rosé. The red wine will come. In 3 years, we will be the number one selling rosé wine brand in the United States of America, that's for sure. In 5 years, there'll be an exit. And then you'll see the other spirits and wine brands come behind it. I will build a wine and spirits company after this.
Another one.
A full-fledged. Yeah.
Tequila, vodka.
All that.
So this is like the starter.
Yeah.
This is the starter to something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the guy behind Avion Tequila, Ken Austin, he's done it now 3 times. Avion Tequila, proper whiskey, and now he's a partner in Termana. Why can't I do that?
So you're already going with the end in mind.
Yeah.
Important. Do you have the end in mind when you started?
No, I thought I was going to have this thing forever. But that was a naive me not understanding.
When did you start to think about that?
The conversations with Constellation.
How far?
I have a great advisor, Robbie Robinson from Pendulum. And probably the first conversation, he's like, you know, there's probably going to be some conversations around them acquiring you whole out throughout this. And I was like, I'm not doing it. And that's when he broke it down. Like, you're being short-sighted because 100% of nothing is nothing, right? 20% of what they could potentially do for you could be life-changing for generations to come.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. The value of selling a company, a lot of times people don't fully appreciate that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Sold PayPal and started SpaceX first, actually. And then he started Tesla.
Yeah.
And, you know, he made a couple hundred million for the first company, but now he's worth a couple hundred billion.
Exactly. You just got to have capital. We don't have liquid capital available a lot of times in our communities. Like, I want that money to go out there and be able to take a risk. I'm going to put X amount of dollars into this next Airbnb and see what happens and not have to really stress about my return.
But funding is obviously an issue. Did you have to go through like that process of actually trying to acquire funding and go through banks? I feel like that might not be. Is that something that banks are like, hey, yeah, let's help fund this black business?
No,
business?
I mean, going to banks was never an option. I knew they were going to say no, right? Okay. There was no track record. The sales wasn't enough. We didn't have enough of our own capital invested, which is why, you know, when we started, we were the only 100% black owned rosé, and we no longer can use that tagline. But that's for a good reason, because when Constellation invested, they took a percentage of the business. So we're not solely black owned. So I think a lot of times in our community as well, they're like, oh, they ain't really black owned. But like, if you understand what it takes to scale and build a business, there's not enough of us to go to go get the amount of money that's needed a lot of time to fund a venture like this. So yeah, I took money on, but I'm okay with that. But I think you need to have that conversation more about like funding and what it means.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I will be tasting this at your... Where can I buy this at?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to his point, like Drizzly, go on there. That's the easiest. But here in the city, you got Happy Cork, you got Parcel Wine, you got Empire Wine. If you drink it at places, you can go to Soho Houses. You can go to like, the gathering spots in Atlanta and D.C. Like, yeah, we try to be everywhere sexy. For me, bro, it's like I'm having the product wherever I want to go. So if it's not there, then it's a problem.
Shout out to the gathering spot.
Is it on a website, the bar?
Yeah, you can go on the website and it'll take you to either, there's two ways, either take you to stores in your area, you can put in your zip code, or you can just buy it through like a wine.com, which we have a direct link.
What's the website called?
www.lafetterose.com, LAFETEROSE.com.
Yeah, I was just going to say our brother Ryan Wilson at the gathering spot. Man. We will be down there shortly.
Yeah.
And so we will definitely I have to make sure that this is on every table.
I mean, Ryan's a good brother. I went to him as soon as I launched the wine. He was like, you black, I'm taking it.
As I knew he would. Yeah. So, Happy Corks too. Shout out to him. They actually have another one of our alumni inside their store. Our folks from Montreal, La Creme. Yeah. So shout out to them. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's my guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Steven. Yeah.
Yeah. Good people.
Yep.
Yep. Well, Troy, housekeeping items?
Yeah, shout out to everybody on Patreon.com. Shout out to all of our earners on EYL University. Y'all already know that's the number one place if you're looking to learn anything in the world of entrepreneurship, business, finance, and investing. We have it all. So shout out to all y'all. Shout out to everybody that's supporting the merch. And shout out to this LaFrette, the rosé of the party.
Old by black man. Thank you, guys. I appreciate y'all having me, for real.
No doubt, man.
Thank you, guys, for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Yeah, man.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.